Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the channel. My name is Jacob Restituto. I'm a musician from Northport, New York, and today I have the absolute pleasure of having Ben O'Neill on the channel, all the way from LA, New York, LA collaboration. Ben, I appreciate you taking the time to chat, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. It's going to be a really good chat. You and I have actually spoken before. We did a little preliminary conversation kind of just to get to know each other a little bit beforehand. So I definitely know it's going to be a good chat.
Nice. Yeah, definitely. Thanks again for having me on. I don't do too many of these. You know, I'm usually just in my studio by myself or with a few artists that I'm working with. So it's cool to have an opportunity to reach out to the larger kind of music community.
Sure, 100%. So for people that aren't super familiar with you, can you give a little bit of backstory on who you are and just kind of how you got into the music industry and what you do?
Yeah, definitely. So basically, nowadays I'm a music mixer, music engineer. My background is primarily in like studio recording engineering. I came out to LA in 2008 and started working in, you know, some of what are the last kind of like large commercial facilities that are left, and then just, you know, haven't left yet, still here, still doing it. And now I've sort of over the last five or six years, I've transitioned more into mixing, which has been a really nice change for me personally. I just find it suits my temperament a little bit better. But I still love getting in the studio with bands and, you know, tracking, but in the context of like a, you know, like a larger project, like the entire scope of it, as opposed to just, you know, bringing a band in, recording them, and then like, okay, see ya, on to the next one, and like doing that back to back day to day for years. Some people love that, and it's a really fun way to spend your time. But for me, I like the mixing side of things a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure. I can see that. Definitely.
Yeah.
It kind of, some the way you're kind of describing it, it's interesting. Like, you don't think about that, but there is somebody that their job is essentially just to set up the band and get the recording sound and tracked, and then they ship them off to the next. It's almost like a assembly line to some degree.
Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the tracking engineers, I would characterize as kind of the unsung heroes of,
sure,
you know, the music making process. Like, it's there are a lot of really fun aspects of it, but it's also, you know, it can be a real grind, man. And like the assistants who work at the major kind of commercial recording facilities, like, they have a tough job. It's, you know, it's long hours. You're dealing with tons of different kinds of personalities, you know, temperamental equipment. Yeah, so it can be a lot, but it's something I would recommend that anyone who is interested in kind of the technical side of learning to record and then gathering the skills that would allow you to become like an ace, whether you're interested in mixing or production or songwriting, like a place like that will expose you to, you know, just tons of different philosophies and methods and different kinds of people, and you'll develop a lot of what would you call them, like soft skills for just learning how to, you know, work with people, because that's really, you know, that's really what we're doing when we're in the studio, is we are, you know, facilitating an experience and a process for people to like get their, you know, their story across. So yeah,
and it's really interesting that you say it like that, because it's kind of like, to some degree, the run and gun of the music industry, where like there's so many things that can go wrong in that moment, and you're often on a time crunch. So, you know, you're at the expense of a lot of different things. Like you said, temperamental equipment, temperamental people, just all these things that can go wrong, as opposed to like mixing, where there's a lot more leeway of like flexibility, essentially.
Yeah. It's a little, you know, there are some differences. There are still some similarities. I just find for myself, you know, being in my own space where I'm kind of, you know, have control over more of the elements than I do when I'm in like a commercial, you know, tracking facility with a band. It just, for me, I like that process better. And I like being able to dive deep into kind of like, you know, crafting the sounds and really, you know, teasing out the emotions in a song. Yeah, it just, after, like, I worked at this studio called East West, which is a fantastic commercial recording facility in Hollywood. It's, like, got a very storied history. It's been around since, you know, I think, like, the late 50s is when it became, like, a commercial recording facility properly. So tons of history there. But I did my like 6 years there, and that was enough for me. And then so moving on to the mixing, which is just a little bit less intense in some
Sure.
aspects,
Sure.
was a nice change of pace. I can have a life now, so
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
nice.
So you said something really interesting in the sense that you said that you kind of moved out there at the last stage of when commercial studios were a thing. So I'd love to hear just your perspective on that.
Yeah,
Are you
definitely.
feeling it transition into more of like personal studios, or what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean the commercial facilities and the entire music industry, in my perspective, are really sitting at the nexus of a lot of, different forces pulling on them, as we all are these days. Things are changing very quickly. Just the changing landscape of how music gets made, how it gets funded, sort of the democratization of music making equipment over the last few years. Like, you can do a lot more on a laptop in a bedroom than you could 15 years ago. And like, I know tons of people who are making incredible, inspired recordings just, in their bedrooms. Like, bedroom pop has become a genre to be reckoned with in the last few years. So yeah, the challenges for a commercial recording facility are that, like, A, the equipment is expensive to maintain, and like I said, it's temperamental. So they have a certain bottom line that, any business has to make. And with the tools now being more widely available for people to do things on their own time, it's sort of like the entire business model that underlies those commercial facilities has changed. And unfortunately, a lot of them have not been able to keep up with the times, and like, the doors have closed. So there's really, compared to what it was maybe in like the 90s, there's really only a handful of these like really historic facilities left. So anytime you get to go and work in one of them, it really, it's a really incredible opportunity, because I think a few of them will probably be there forever, but it's just not like it was, 15 years ago. And like, I'm 32 and I already sound like I'm an old guy. I'm like, "Ah,
Ah.
the good old days, man." Yeah.
No, that
But
is super interesting, man. And it's really interesting as growing up as a musician, I don't even know how you'd explain it. Just like we all have these like kind of expectations of what, or I guess levels or beliefs of what we think, the levels of your career might be. It's like, oh, you, first off, you put your music out there, then you get signed to a label. Then you get, once you're signed to a label, you start getting to record at these really nice studios, and then your music sounds really good, and like it's like all these bench. Then it's like then you win a Grammy. Like all we have all these benchmarks, right? And it's really interesting that how a lot of musicians, including myself to some degree, gets kind of stuck in that mentality. When like you mentioned, it's the music industry has shifted a bit, and like you can make phenomenal music without having to spend. A cheap studio's, a couple $100 an hour, but if you want to go to these professionals, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars for your recordings, if not hundreds of thousands, depending on how far you're going to go,
Yeah,
And
definitely.
I don't know if the average listener notices the difference or even cares, compared to a bedroom pop song.
Yeah, ultimately, like, the most important thing when it comes to, a song is it's the song, really. So, some of like the most classic recordings that we have, you go back and you listen to them now, like, I'm talking like Beatles recordings, stuff like that, like really classic legacy stuff. You listen back to it and it's like, it's not perfect by any means. Like, there's mistakes all over the place. There's like sonic imperfections, but another name for those would be character, right?
Sure.
So, yeah. So like, but the most important thing is like, is the song good?
Yeah.
And then all the other stuff, like all the equipment, all the gear, all the fancy microphones and all that, that's just extra, and it can, yeah, we can really, as a engineer or like a technical person who doesn't know what they're doing, we can really take those tools and harness them to like really bring that idea to life. But it's all downstream of how good is the song, how good is the arrangement, and how talented are you as the artist, executing that vision. So yeah, so with, like, we're talking about kind of the sort of how would you phrase it? Like the access to technology has changed so much over the last few years that now, you know, if you have a UAD Apollo interface, you know, you have some really good emulations of that classic gear. And if you even know what you're doing a little bit, like, and you have a great idea, you can really execute that, you know, in your imperfect recording space, whatever that happens to be. And so it's really allowed artists to, you know, spend a lot more time kind of crafting their ideas on their own before it even gets to the phase where you're like thinking about maybe taking it into a studio or passing it on to a mixer or, you know, starting to work with other producers on that idea, which in my view has been, it's been really cool, man. There's been a lot of really interesting sounding and very inspired sort of recordings coming out the last few years as a result of that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You're right, kind of like it's creating this new. You're right. That's it. My mind's just spinning in a thousand different directions talking about all the different things in the sense of like how the music industry is changing. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm starting to just notice all these. It's like, you know, like when you get a new car and now you notice all the other cars that were like your car that you now just bought. It's kind of like that in the sense of like, oh, we talked about the music industry changing, and now I'm seeing all these different areas in my head of how the music industry is changing. Like you just said, all this kind of new area of creativity that's now accessible because you don't have to, you know, you're not on a time crunch. Like you could spend 6 months if you really wanted to working on a song, creating your own sound rather than, oh, I rented out the studio for 6 hours, you know, because it was $700 an hour or whatever the case, you know. Or I don't, you know. And I mean that, like I said, that's even a cheap one compared to, you know, these professional, like if you want to rent out Warner Brothers studio, but
Yeah, definitely, definitely. But I think, you know, people are they're very savvy and they're pretty smart with how they do it now. So, you know, a lot of bands that I work with, like, will do a pretty extensive sort of pre-production phase where, you know, we can work in somebody's living room if we need to, you know, with an Apollo and or whatever they happen to have, and we can really sketch out these ideas and make sure that they're fully fleshed out. And then you can kind of pick and choose. You're like, okay, we know for this set of songs, we really want that like big, you know, kind of like rock room sound or something like that for the drums. So we want to go to, for instance, East West Studio 2, and we can really make sure that we're making the most of the budget and the time that we have. And then a lot of the other stuff can be just done anywhere. You know, if you're just recording guitars, or if you're doing, you know, keyboard synth programming, like that stuff doesn't really require, you know, a big room to do that. So, yeah, so there's still a lot of possibilities available for people, you know, depending how they want to, you know, achieve the final product. And there's no right way to do it. There might be some ways that work better than others, but there's no right or wrong way.
So, on a total curious note, this is like I think the third time you mentioned the UAD devices or UAD products, which is for those that don't know, is Universal Audio. They make the Apollo, typically the Apollo Twin or the I think there's like what the Apollo Quad and stuff like that.
Yeah, they have like everything from just the small two-channel interfaces all the way up to like, you know, 16-channel input, you know, interfaces, that kind of thing.
So oftentimes you will hear that as being referenced as like an industry standard, like everybody that's not in a like, you know, Warner Brothers studio is using an Apollo. Do you notice that being actually like just be like become like the trend, or do you think you actually hear a sonic difference?
I mean, really the appeal, I mean, for me as a mixer, you know, it's a little different than maybe someone who is a like a vocal producer or something like that. The way that I use them is just it allows me to have, you know, as close as possible to, you know, the analog gear that I would love to be mixing on all the time, but don't want to spend, you know, the $100,000 acquiring necessarily. You know, kind of at my fingertips and instantly recallable. And the sound quality, I think, you know, there's a few people out there who are probably have like, you know, scary dog hearing who can tell the difference. They're like, you know, oh, you know, 28K, like I hear it's 3 dB down. I'm like, most people are never going to hear that. The emulations that they have, the software is really good. It's really well done.
So you use a
And
lot of their like the Universal Audio emulations that they have.
sure. Yeah. When I
Interesting.
mix, I use it a lot. And I know people, you know, the way the interfaces are set up, you can record through that equipment with very little latency. So if you're tracking vocals, you know, kind of the industry standard, you know, vocal chain is a a good microphone into a Neve 1073 preamp into like a TubeTech CL1B compressor, right? So that chain out of the box would cost you, I don't know, like $20,000, not counting the mic. But, you know, in the UAD world, you can open that right up and you can have it for, you know, a fraction of that cost. And then you can take it anywhere with you. You know, it's going to work every time you open it up. Yeah, I see a lot of people tracking through that kind of stuff.
And you,
But
as somebody that's in these big studios, you find that it's a comparable comparison.
yeah, I've shot them out. I've done, you know, in my own studio here, I happen to have, you know, a real 1073 and a real TubeTech. I'm very lucky to have that. And so I've shot it out, you know, against the like the UAD chain. And there's, you know, there's some subtle differences in like maybe how, you know, signal reacts in the compressor than it does on the analog unit. But I mean, I wouldn't say that should stop you at all. Like it's damn close and it sounds really good. So like if I'm working with an artist and we do some vocals at my studio and like I record a lot with like an SM7 these days just because I know it's a cheap mic, it's a really good recording mic. I mean, if it was good enough for Michael Jackson, it's probably got to be good enough for you too. And then that's one that I know, like that thing you could run it over with a truck and it would still work. So I can send that home with the artist, and if they have the an Apollo, they can start working on some, you know, vocal overdubs using pretty much the exact same chain in their own space where they're comfortable on their own time. And I find that's pretty invaluable for, you know, because a lot of those ideas that, you know, they strike you like in the middle of the night or like when you're in the shower or something. So providing that, you know, ability for people to capture on their own time in a space where they're comfortable and they're not under the gun of like the expensive studio clock is it's really useful.
Is the SM7, it's a Shure microphone, correct?
Yeah,
So is
it's
it
like a
different than
broadcast
this is it
mic.
oh is it the 7B or is it a different microphone?
Yeah, the SM7B. Yep.
Oh, okay, I wasn't sure if there was like, because like, you know how like you get a 58, like there's they make the regulars and then make the betas, so I wasn't sure
Yeah.
if it was like a different microphone or not, but very
There
interesting.
might be,
So
I
I've
don't
been
know. I've
seeing a lot of people track on that, and I've been really surprised at to see that. You know, like I'll watch, like, you know, the I'm talking like, you know, like I watched the video of Ed Sheeran tracking one of his songs, and he was tracking into a 7B. I was like, I'm really surprised that he's not using like, you know, one of these like, whatever, you know,
Yeah, and I
Telefunken.
mean, there's, you know, there's some like complicated technical reasons like we could get into why, you know, the kind of high-end like tube condenser microphones like the U47s and the 251s of the world, like they're fantastic microphones, but you know, they were designed in the era of tape. Now we're recording on, you know, we're using digital converters, and so there's some differences. So there is a good reason to maybe use like a dynamic microphone for recording your vocal, or at least not to be afraid of doing it. Like, don't, my message to people would be, don't worry so much about the tools. Like, just worry about the ideas first, because that's what really matters, is the idea, the song, the execution of that. The technical stuff, like, yes, it does matter, but it's all downstream of the idea.
It's really interesting that you say that, because I was just I'll give an example. Like I was listening to something with my wife in the car. It's funny that it comes up as a throwback. We were listening to throwbacks, and the Chainsmokers track Roses came up, and I was like, "Geez, this is considered a throwback now? It's like not that old." But it's really interesting that that's one of the songs that put them on the map. And I mean, they had a couple songs prior to, like, you know, but like Roses was a big hit for them, and you listen to something like that quality compared to like what they're making now, it's a world of a difference. But it's interesting in the sense of like you said, the execution wasn't, you know, as good as it is now, but it got them to where they needed to so that they can make productions at this new level, essentially. Like the idea was good enough that the production level didn't necessarily matter, because you listen to it, you compare it to something that they released like last year, and it's worlds of a difference. You know, it's like, you know, quality wise, sonically, songwriting wise, whatever the case is, totally different story. But like sonically, you could tell one was recorded in a New York City apartment and one was recorded, you know, with a $100,000 budget, right? So, but it's interesting in the sense of like it didn't matter because that song was still on the radio. And now they just have the resources now to pay to use the Telefunken whatever, you know.
Sure.
It's just it's interesting to see that you're right. Focus. It's not necessarily the tools. It's the execution of the idea.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, as a mixer, like, I would love to live in a perfect world where people had, you know, at least the same amount of budget going into their production as they do for the mixing phase. Like, I think it's a common mistake to think like, oh, we'll fix it in the mix later. Like, no, it doesn't quite work like that. You know, we can take what you give us and we can make it better, but, you know, we can't go back and like reinvent the wheel entirely. So like, yes, I would love to see, you know, people increase their production skills. Not to say there's not a ton of great producers out there already, but, you know, it's like a lifelong pursuit, right? Like, you can always get better at it, and it's only going to make the end product better. But really, like, a song is, it's like a vehicle for, you know, for conveying an emotion and like transporting it to another human being. And like that, that's what the song is. Like, that's what it's for. And so, yeah, sound quality, like, you know, we've all heard like old, you know, recordings done on like, I don't know, like 2-track tape that, you know, it's a fantastic song and it moves you and it transports you emotionally to like to a place that you weren't at before. And I think if we focus on that and focus on songcraft first, like, you know, we'll get better songs out of it, and then everything gets better from there. It's like the foundation.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's really interesting. So that's a phenomenal point. Like, I think that we, in this modern age where this technology is so readily available, at least myself, as somebody who does a lot of my own production and mixing, it's so easy to get caught up in that stage of it. You know, oh, where, how does the snare sit in the track? And it's like, in the end, it doesn't necessarily matter. Like, you're right, there's so many songs out there where it's all about the song, you know what I mean? And not necessarily about this. Oh, the snare needs to be pushed a little more 8K because, you know, we need a little more top end. You know, like, it doesn't matter, but we get so caught up in that.
Definitely. I think it's smart to maybe kind of separate out your sort of like ideation phase of creating a song in production from sort of the technical like editing side of stuff. Because if you start getting caught up in that too early on, you know, you're going to be chasing that, like, you know, oh, like the snare's too bright now. Like, when you're writing a song and you're like, okay, now I got to make the vocal brighter to compensate for that. So it's on, sits on top of that. And it's like, now I can't hear the snare. And I go back and you know, make an adjustment there. It's like, maybe, you know, put that aside for now and just, you know, focus on the song first. And then once you're done, you know, kind of ideating, creating, then set aside some separate time to start going through that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal tip. I'm curious, though, you mentioned in your last statement that, like, a lot of people will send you stuff hoping that they'll fix it and you'll fix it in post or in the mixing stage, right? So as somebody that deals with a lot of that, essentially, where essentially people send you mixes, what are some tips you can give to people pre-mixing that would help to when they get it to the mixing stage?
Man, there's a lot there. You know, these days, like, just like kind of going back and opening up that question a little bit, like, things have really changed even in just like the 14 years that I've been doing this like professionally. You know, nowadays, like, I used to get songs from people and I would just get, you know, raw multi-track audio files, right? It's just a, you know, like a Pro Tools session or a folder containing audio files, you know, that are essentially raw, or they have these sounds, you know, already kind of consolidated into them. So we're starting from a blank slate, basically. Fast forward to where we're at now, and I find on a lot of the, you know, records that I work on, like, if I ask a producer to give me their song like that, it's not going to work, because they've already done a lot of kind of like sort of pre-mixing or mixing, if you will, to get it to the state where, you know, the band likes it, you know, the band's mom likes it, you know, the band's grandma, they like it too. Like, so now it's more about, you know, okay, I want to be able to take that session exactly with all of your plugins, all of your routing, everything. And I want to start from that point. And then I'll go back through and kind of, you know, kind of correct some of the common issues that I see, you know, like gain staging, you know, maybe making vocals like too wet or not wet enough, stuff like that. So All that being said, like there's quite a few things that you can do to help your sort of like mixes and production ideas translate if you're passing it off to an actual mixer. And it goes back to just like basic sort of engineering skills. We're talking like, gain staging in your session, right? Like if you're starting your session with all of your faders at zero, you only have 12 dB, right, above that in most DAWs to be able to turn things up. And I see this a lot where people are fighting, like, I need the kick to be louder, so I'm going to bring that up. And then I need the vocal to be louder, I'm going to bring that up. And then, oh, now I can't hear the keys, so I'm going to bring that up. And then they end up with all of their faders, like, all the way up at the top of the throw of the fader in the session. So, a really good tip I would have for people would be start with the faders pretty low in your session and then use a really high quality gain stage to get it louder on the back end. So most people, will have some sort of like stereo bus or a master bus in their session, right? So like pick a good compressor or a limiter that you can get really good clean gain out of, and like maybe start with 6 dB of gain already added to that master. So like when you're mixing into it, it's providing a gain bump for you that you're not doing downstream, because that affects how everything else works in the session. And for the most part, the first thing I do when I get somebody's song to mix is I go back and I undo all of their bad gain staging. So that would be one. Another one, like a common one that I see a lot, is like what I like to call a waterfall of buses, where it's like, okay, I have a kick bus going into a drum bus, going into a drum sub bus, going into a, drums and bass bus, going into a sub master for the bus. And it's like there's like 15 paths to get to the final print. In general, maybe try to simplify that a little bit. Like, that's not necessarily better, just, and if you're not getting the sound that you want, like kind of right on the channel, or right on the microphone that you're recording, whatever the part happens to be on, like the closer you can start to getting the sound you want at the source, the better it's going to be, and that also means like if you have to put, like I think in Pro Tools there's 10, yeah, there's 10 plugin inserts on each track. If you have to put, 10 plugins on there to like get the sound you want because you're chasing something and you're trying to like fix other problems, not because it's like, hey, I created this really cool creative sound using 10 plugins. Like that's beautiful, more power to you. But maybe try to do it with like one or two plugins, like challenge yourself. So for anyone out there who's like trying to learn how to mix, I would recommend, like most people these days have like 1,000 plugins in their plugin list that all do roughly the same thing, like 1,000 different EQs. Maybe just pick one, and for a couple weeks, give yourself like one compressor, one EQ, one or two reverbs, and then like a few things that you like to use on your stereo bus, and take everything else and pull it out of your plugins folder and just start with those.
It's
And
true,
like
man.
really learn what you can do with like the SSL channel strip. Like the Waves SSL channel strip is a super popular, emulation of these classic SSL consoles that people mixed tons of hit records on. Maybe just start with that and like really learn the ins and outs of that plugin. Like take the knobs, turn them all the way up, all the way down, see what they do, get extreme with stuff to really kind of learn what it does, and then try to push that as far as you can, because you'll learn quite a bit in the process. And then once you kind of know what you're doing, start adding in more, options into your tools list. But that's just for mixing. I can't really speak to, production as far as like making the tracks go and stuff like that, because I'm sure people have soft synths that they love that, they need to do certain things with to get it to sound the way they want. Like that's fine. But as far as the mixing phase goes, like sometimes simpler is better.
Do you find yourself, this is totally a piggyback question off the SSL question or statement, do you find yourself mixing more of like with the British style, mixing with the three knobs, the high, medium, and low, essentially? Or do you typically go in there like with like a parametric EQ and, give the whole, you could see everything on there. Do you find yourself?
It depends. It really depends. If it's a very well recorded source, then I can get away with like some kind of broader sort of EQ moves. But a lot of times, in the stuff that I'm getting now, I need to go in and I need to do some corrective EQ.
Yeah.
So my favorite tool for that is just ProQ from FabFilter. It's very simple, it's not DSP intensive. I also recommend, if you want to train your ears as a mixer, turn off the graphic, representation on your EQ and like actually force yourself to hear it and like find it and
Yeah.
learn it that way.
That's
And
actually
then
just a
when
great exercise in general to like, because sometimes you see things and you're like, oh, I think I need to fix that, when in reality, like, you don't, you know what I mean?
And not to get too far ahead, but that's another trick that I have that I recommend for people is like have a hotkey on your screen when you're actually mixing, like go to a screensaver, because like we use our ears, like music is about our ears, and so much of kind of the modern workflow is about what we see with our eyes. And so I don't know, maybe it's like really deep and philosophical, but I feel like you can hear it in people's work that they're not listening, they're looking,
Wow, that's
right?
very interesting.
You're looking at waveforms, you're looking at, somebody told you in a tutorial somewhere that 1.2K is an offensive frequency. So like you're looking for that frequency in the graphic readout, and then you're just like taking it out and you're like, I don't know. I always start with like, does that serve the song?
Yeah.
Is that what's going to make the song better? Like, how is this, kind of impacting me emotionally? And I can't see that. I have to hear it and I have to feel it.
Yeah.
So
No, I
yeah.
think that
But
that's some
anyways, I'm
phenomenal tips.
so prone to tangents, man. Just stop me.
No, these are phenomenal. They're phenomenal points, because that's the reality of it. I think that so many of us, we get so caught up in completely unnecessary things, chasing things. We think we need the best gear. We think we need. Dude, I've had some really interesting conversations with people here on the channel, like people that have been like nominated for these Grammy-winning songs or going to the Grammys every year. And then I was talking to them about like what kind of gear they use, and like, yeah, I use FabFilter for everything. I'm like, and it's just like, you think prior to that, me thinking even to myself, like, you think you need all this. Here's this guy going to the Grammys for these songs that he's working on, and he's using a $200 plugin. You know what I mean? Like, and it's like, these conversations has broken the mold of like, you don't need 1,000 plugins. You don't need the $900 EQ. It's like, you just need to be good. It's just the difference is the guy's been doing it for 40 years and he knows what he's doing. You know what I mean?
Totally,
So,
man. Yeah, the real tool is the brain in
yeah.
between the ears. Like everything else is down, it's like it's all downstream of that. So I think for me in my learning process and kind of how I got here, it's really been about kind of trying to distill what I want to do down to kind of like what are the core sort of principles of it. And then everything that's extra on top of that, I just try to eliminate it until I feel like I'm really solid with the tools that I have and I understand what I'm doing. And then I'll start adding more complexity into that because, I mean, I don't know. See, sometimes I go into people's sessions or even my own Pro Tools rig and start to mix something, and I have, I try to have like every plugin made just because I get a lot of sessions from people, so I want to be able to open them up. But I feel like I'm like scrolling through Netflix sometimes.
That was my exact question, actually, though. I was going to ask about that. It's saying, like, so when somebody sends you a session, I was going to ask, what do you do if you don't have the plugin? Is there a workaround around that? You just have to have the plugin.
I usually buy it,
Yeah,
which
okay,
is
that's super
unfortunate.
interesting. Yeah, I was curious. I was like, because I got to know that workaround, because that's an incredible, even between my two computers, that's an incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, a trick for people who don't maybe have the money to invest in the plugins, because it is expensive, unfortunately. I know that's a barrier to a lot of people. Splice is a good resource. They got the rent to own
Yeah.
plugin thing, and then for a lot of plugins, you can get free demos too. So if you're an up and coming mixer and you get a session from somebody that has a specific plugin on it, maybe before you go buy it, you might only need it this one time for this one thing. So see if there's a free demo out there that you can grab, and then just, commit that chain down so you have that sound if that's important to you. Or, another really good skill is just kind of learning to work around it. And that's
Yeah,
like, use
recreating
your
the sound
ears.
without the plugin,
Yeah,
for
recreate it. But
sure.
you got to be really careful, because you don't want to change the intent of the producer. And so I always try to have a conversation with the artist or the production team before I even start a mix. Like I will, most of the time I'll refuse to mix a song from somebody if I can't get them on the phone for 5 minutes before. And like, I want to hear, I want to hear your reference mix. I want to hear, what do you like about it? What don't you like about it? I think that was a, it was a big lesson for me to learn early on in my career because, I came up under a mixer who was like a very accomplished sort of like, old school mixer. And like he had gotten to a point in his career when I started apprenticing for him and learning from him where people were coming to him for his sound, And so he would get your song and he would do this masterfully, don't get me wrong. He would imprint, his kind of like, aggressive mixing style onto this song, and that's what people were coming to them for. And then I think I internalized from that that, hey man, like you're the mixer, dude. People are sending you their song. They want you to completely take it apart and deconstruct it and then build it back up way better than they ever could have. And that was such like a ego trap to get stuck in. And so, because maybe that's not what the client wants, maybe they really, really like their reference mix and they just want it a little bit better, maybe they want to swap out some of the vocal verbs for something a little more expensive sounding, but the overall shape of it, they really like it. So that means that your job is just to maybe make it a little bit, a little bit louder, a little bit better, fix any kind of like glaring issues, and maybe it's not a lot of work actually. So it's like different tools that you need to know when to bring out which tool. And if you are kind of like in your head about it or have an ego about it, you might not pick the right approach. So,
100%. It's totally a humility, like the quality is in the humility for sure, because you're really there to serve the artist's purpose and or their goal essentially. And but yeah man, it's totally easy to get caught up in the, well, this is what I want to do kind of thing, and or this is what I would do even though that's not what the artist wants.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. And I think that also probably translates to like if you're a producer, I've seen it happen a lot in sessions where, a certain producer will have an idea for what the song should be and maybe kind of steamrolls over the artist and that's not really what they wanted. And then they probably don't get the call back for that gig. So yeah, it's kind of like you said, like there's a, I think it pays to be humble, but also be confident and like know what you can do and what you can bring to the table, but also know that like there's a time and a place to like to bring that skill out, and maybe not every situation requires that skill. So,
100%. No, it's really, it's a phenomenal point. I think that one a lot of people can learn something from. But to go back to an earlier point that you made about the songwriting and maybe making the focus the song rather than the actual, mixing production back end of it. You've worked with a lot of artists, a ton of artists, phenomenal artists, including some that people might know, being whether it be like American Authors, Newsboys, Chris Tomlin, Fleetwood Mac. You, a lot of those people have some really popular, great songs. So I would love to know from your perspective. I love getting this, and there's no right answer to it because if you had the right answer, you'd be a trillionaire, right? What do you
Look
find?
around, dude. No, I'm kidding.
What do you find the secret to a great song is?
Oh man, dude, I have no idea. If I could answer that question for you, like you said, I
Well,
wouldn't
that's what I
be a teacher.
said. So in your
I
perspective, though,
would.
you've worked with some great artists that, like I said, have had the quote unquote successful songs, right? So if you were to dissect looking back at some of these songs, there's no right answer, because like I said, you had the right answer, you'd. Then again, there are some people like Max Martin that obviously has some formula that's working, right? But like, what are you personally seeing? What do you see in these songs? Even to some degree, let's just take random Chris Tomlin for an example, right? He has 200 songs out there, but there's only like nine of them that people really know. So what do you see in those nine that are the ones that like make them the hit songs?
I mean, what I see when I look at that is hundreds, if not thousands, of attempts to write a really incredible song and failing at it, and then, moving on and learning from that. I think the only thing that I can really say about that, just because I'm not a songwriter, and the people who do that, I have a ton of respect for because it's think it's like any art form, man. It's like it's very tough to pin down, like, you know, what is it that makes this piece of art great? I don't know, but I think it at the core of it, it moves people in a certain way emotionally. And like you said, Max Martin, guys like that, they certainly have discovered some kind of formula about, you know, what works. And that probably, I mean, that probably has to do with like our kind of evolution as humans, you know, and like how our bodies feel sound, how our ears hear sound, you know, certain experiences that we have all shared for thousands of years, you know, evolving to this point to where we're at now, in terms of like sound selection and frequency sort of representation. But it really, I think it boils down to like the song moves people emotionally, and it provides like, I think something I've noticed is that all the great songs out there, they're like, they tell you a story that is simultaneously specific enough, yet vague enough that it's a relatable story, but it's vague enough that you can put your own experiences like into that song, and it makes sense to you, and it resonates with you on a deeper level, or probably on multiple deep levels. I remember when I was working on the Fleetwood Mac record, which actually was released as a Buckingham McVie record. There was some drama between, you know, the bandmates. So yeah, it didn't come out as a Fleetwood Mac record, but you know, for all intents and purposes, it was Fleetwood Mac. Talking about, you know, the songwriting on Rumours and how that happened, and like, you know, some of the biggest songs on that record were written in 5 minutes. It just, you know, and we've heard, I know we've all heard the stories of like how, you know, like Dylan and a lot of these prolific songwriters, they just got themselves into a specific, you know, they were in the right time and the right place and the right state of mind, and like the song just came to them. So I don't know, man. Maybe there's like a song god, you know, floating above us all, and if you like align yourself properly, like you'll just download the magic song or something like that. But it's certainly a skill and it can be practiced, but I am unfortunately, like I said, I'm not a songwriter, so
No,
I
but I
can't
think
tell
you
you
have
how
some
to
good
practice
insight.
that.
You have some really good insight in the fact, like you said, like it's specific enough that you relate, or that it tells a story, but it's vague enough that you can relate to it. And it's what the interesting part about that is, I think that might be why some songs are relatable to some people and some are not. You know, that's why like some people connect to this song, but I don't, and then you can I connect to that song, but they don't. You know, and it's because we relate to these different stories that, you know. And then the hit songs, the ones that the majority of people can relate to.
Yeah, you know, I think we call them like timeless, you know, the timeless ones.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
They probably really hit on some very deep truth about what it means to be a human and have like a human experience, and have done it in such a beautiful artistic way that it, you know, yeah, allows people to connect with it from many different periods in time and walks of life and stuff like that.
Yeah,
But for
it's
me as
so
a
interesting.
mixer, you know, I find like I'm a lot more sensitive to arrangement than the actual, you know, like the songwriting. Like, don't tell anybody that I mix for, but like I don't really hear the lyrics that much when I'm mixing. Like, I have to sit down and actually like focus and be like, oh, this song is about a breakup. Like, I didn't actually, you know,
Sure.
I didn't realize that. So that's a practice that I've incorporated into sort of my like pre-mixing phase now, is to actually like, okay, not only did I hear all the stuff that catches my ears as a mixer, but I've listened down to the lyrics now too, and I know, you know, what the story is about and what the artist is trying to convey. But, you know, arrangement is also super important in a, you know, in a song as well. And it makes a huge difference in the final mix as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting, man. Yeah. There's so many different factors of it, but you're totally right. And sometimes, like you said, which is kind of interesting, the arrangement of the music and the mix of the music will partner with the lyrics, in the sense of like, you know, they will enhance, I guess you could say, the lyrics, make you feel like if you were to take out the lyrics, you could still feel what the artist is trying to say without the words. And that's the
Definitely.
goal for them. The word I'm looking for is complement. They would complement the lyrics and the emotion of the song through the guitars, the piano, and how those are mixed. You know, you mix a guitar super harsh, in a breakup song, it's a totally different vibe than if you have this very luscious, ethereal kind of vibe in the breakup song. And they could still both work. It's just you're getting two totally different vibes.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, when it comes to a mix phase, like my greatest tool that I have is the mute button. Like a lot of times, like I'll just be like, obviously, like there'll usually be a conversation with the producer or something before that. I'd be like, I want to send you two different versions of this mix. One of them I'm going to pull out, this whatever thing entirely and let you hear it this way. And then I'm going to also give it to you the way that you gave it to me so you can hear both. Like I don't want to have the ego to say that this shouldn't exist there, but I'm curious what it would be like if it didn't exist and
Yeah.
just making some space in an arrangement.
Do you ever find, to piggyback on that, do you ever find you wanting more production in the song? Or is it almost always you pulling things out?
These days, it's typically things are overproduced. Another common mistake that I see from people is, like, for instance, trying to get a big kick drum sound in a song. Like, I will get sessions that have 10 different kick drums in them, like all stacked on top of each other. And then when I go in and look at them, like via the waveforms, I can see that, they're not all in like aligned with each other and they're out of phase and they're like canceling each other out in certain ways. And usually I'll mute like 9 out of the 10. And then that, results in a better kick sound than they gave me before. Yeah, the sort of like limitless track count that we have now in the digital world, it's a double-edged sword. It's like it's really cool that we are not constrained by, the same limitations that our, maybe kind of like our parents' generation of music creators had if they were working on tape or something like that, where you're limited to 24 or 48 tracks. But you got to use that power wisely, man. Like, don't abuse it.
I completely understand that, and it's hard, man. It's the self-control that is hard. I've been wanting to for years, and I haven't done it yet. But I've been wanting to do almost like a project of, I think I want to do like 12 releases of 12 tracks on each song, like and like say like it can only have 12 tracks. Then I guess why I started getting like it's like, oh, are the drums one track or are the drums, five tracks, seven tracks, you know what I mean? Like that's where I started getting a little like, okay, well that's, I guess, I don't know. And then I just scrapped the idea, but it's like, I want to do that because you're right. Oh, you're like, oh, let me put the synth pad in the right ear only, and let me put another synth pad in the left ear to fatten it up, and then let's double track the guitars. And it's like, yeah, but does it really serve the purpose of the song? It's so interesting to go back and listen to some of my favorite songs and realize how simple they are. You have a mono guitar in the left ear, and a piano going on. Like my favorite all-time band is The Fray. And like just listening to some of their stuff, it's like it's incredibly simple. It's, like six instruments maybe, and it's like the guitar is not double tracked with a stereo delay so that you hear it in the right ear and the left. It's like, no, it's just, it's going on in the left ear. That's, if you take the left ear off, you don't hear the guitar. You know what I mean?
Dude,
And
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm a little bit, I have like slight Luddite tendencies. Like I really appreciate all the technology that we have now. I think it's, opened up a lot of really cool
sure.
doors. But at the same time, man, like I can tell that you read the Tape Op article where they talked about, putting the guitar in the left speaker and doing the delay in the right speaker. And like, yeah, it's cool to try that and everything. But like, did you need to do that? Did that help you convey the emotion of the song that you're hearing? Like, I think it's cool, that all this information is floating around out there and we can learn from it. But, I also think it's impacting what we consider like an original idea now. Like
Very
if we're
interesting.
constantly like taking in so much in like information and stimulus and maybe not just trusting our gut and like
Wow.
what feels good to us. So I don't know, man. I think there is an argument these days to be like, pull a Bonavera, dude. Like, go rent a cabin,
Oh, I love that
up in the
idea, dude.
woods with no service for a while, and like take your two favorite synths and a drum machine up there and an SM7 and like go make something. Like,
I
go,
was
don't
just
listen
talking to
to.
my wife about that. I was like, I think I might go away for 3 days.
Like, just, listen to yourself. Like, trust yourself. What sounds cool to you? Like, don't try to be somebody else. Like, try
Yes.
to use your own ears, and trust that. And
That is, it's an inc that's an incredibly interesting point in the sense of like you just said, like we have so much information that to some degree a lot of people aren't thinking for, myself included often, aren't thinking for themselves. We're like, oh, I heard this, I heard Phineas do this in the new Billie Eilish thing, so let me try it out. It must work, right? So it's, but you're right, as opposed to when this information wasn't floating all around, you had to be creative yourself. You did, the only reason you put the stereo delay in the right ear is because you had that idea to do it, and you liked how it sounded, rather than being like, oh, I heard Foo Fighters, just do it, let me do it. You know what I mean? Like, that's a very interesting point.
But I think, you know, once again, like, no shame. There's no right or wrong 100%. Any of this stuff. I think, you know, there is, that's the thing about, like, a song. Like, it's also a balance between, like, you know, repetition, familiarity, you know, but also it needs to have some surprise in there for you too. It needs to, like, you know, you kind of like trick the listener's brain a little bit. Like, yeah, I'm sure we've all done this where we've heard a song and we're like listening through the verse and you're like, oh yeah, I get this vibe. I kind of know where it's going to go. And then the chorus drops and it just goes like hard left where you didn't expect at all. And you're like, oh man, like I am pleasantly surprised in a really cool way that this violated my expectations. Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like a balance between, like, you know, order. Like, you want things to be, you know, ordered a certain way in your song and have a structure, but also like incorporating a little bit of, like, you know, a little chaos in there too, so that there's some surprises for your listener, or something unique about it that's not, you know, totally self-contained. So
no, that's phenomenal, man. You had some, I'm this has been a phenomenal conversation because you had some really interesting insights, and I really appreciate you taking the time, man. So I want to be respectful of your time.
You know, actually, I was going to say, my client just pushed back another 30 minutes, so I can go a little bit longer if you have. I know we didn't actually touch at all on, like, for your audience, like, if you wanted to do this, how would you go about doing this, like, getting into this?
I guess, selfishly, I started following your tangent because I love this stuff, man. Like, I record and mix all my own stuff, so, like, I'm like eating out of your lap all, like, you know, the things you're saying.
Yeah, man, I'm like, I said, I'm so prone to tangents, so I apologize if there was something that your audience wanted maybe to hear about. I'd definitely be open to, like, taking some questions from people, and I can respond by email to that as well.
That's a phenomenal idea, absolutely. But so let's do a quick tangent on that. I would love to hear how you got into the industry. So how did you? Because you I think you said I read that you were from Arizona. Is that correct?
No, I went to school in Arizona. I grew up in Colorado, kind of like Front Range. Yeah.
Colorado, Arizona. How did you land a job at a decently well-off studio? How did that happen? Because I think that's the gap that a lot of people kind of miss out on.
Yeah. You know, I was really lucky. Like, I've been super, super lucky in my career, and I've had a ton of help to get to the point where I'm at now. So, like, I did not do this on my own. And I'm very grateful to everyone who's helped me to get to this point. Basically, the long story short is, like, my mom had an acoustic guitar in our basement when I was a kid, and, like, I heard Hendrix when I was like 13, and I was like, I want to do that. You know, I grew up playing the band instruments, and I was like, I want to play guitar. Like, you can't solo on a saxophone. Like, sorry, Kenny G, but it's true. And so my parents were cool enough, like, as I started learning to play guitar, I think for a lot of us, it's natural evolution. Like, I wanted to learn how to record myself playing guitar. So my parents were super cool, and they got me, like, one of the very first versions of Pro Tools when I was like 13. So I had, like, a shitty Dell laptop in my parents' basement, and I, like, went to some garage sales and I found some, like, old PA speakers, and I just had, like, a Frankenstein lab in my parents' basement where I would terrorize them while they were trying to eat dinner upstairs, just making all sorts of horrible sounds. And it was great. It was awesome. They really provided that space for me to just kind of explore sounds and play around. And so, you know, I graduated from high school in 2008, kind of right when shit was hitting the fan economically, and, you know, looked at the price of a degree, and I was like, yeah, you know, I don't know if I really need to do that for what I want to do. Like, I want to do sound stuff. And so I found a school in Arizona called the Conservatory of Recording Arts and Sciences. It's a fancy name for a very small school, and it's a bunch of cool people there that basically, you know, it's a 9-month crash course and, like, basic kind of studio stuff, and then they hook you up with an internship at the end of that. And when I got time, or when it got to be time for me to pick a place to intern, they give you like a few cities you can go to where they have connections with studios. They have like Chicago, New York, Nashville, and LA. I almost moved out to Chicago for some reason, which in retrospect, I'm so glad I didn't. But I heard from a friend that there was this spot in Hollywood that used to be called Cello. It's a very famous recording studio where like a bunch of like Chili Peppers and Audio Slave and like kind of that Rick Rubin, era of music was made. And I heard that they might be reopening because they had been closed. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna take a chance and try to go out there. And I happened to land at their doorstep just as they were reopening after they had been closed for 3 years while they were switching management. So Cello became East West. And so I was super lucky to like slide in at the ground floor, where there was nobody above me there. Like there was no staff where you had to like work your way up the ranks from, intern to, a runner getting people's food to, all that. And I did do a bit of that while I was there, but like I said, I was very fortunate to land in a facility where there was actually like room to grow in that place, and there was no, competition. I've heard stories from people, that it can be pretty cutthroat in a lot of studios where, there's maybe like a runner's staff, and then there's limited sort of like assistant engineer positions, and there's like competition for that kind of stuff. I did not have that experience, and I was also very lucky that East West was just reopening and they were just bringing the rooms back online after they had been closed down for a few years. So I made good friends with the tech at the studio, and like I knew how to use a soldering iron and a screwdriver, and they kind of put me to work. So instead of going to get people's food, they were like, "Hey, we need to install and calibrate this Pro Tools rig in the studio. Like, you can do that, right?" And it's like, "Sure, figure that out." So I found a way to kind of make myself valuable to the organization, and that also provided me a way to really learn the ins and outs of that room and that studio, so that when the sessions did start coming in, they're like, "Oh, Ben knows that room backwards and forwards. Let's throw him in there." And then I worked at East West for about 5 years, and then while I was there, I met a bunch of, producers and engineers and people like that. And then eventually, one of them, who was a mixer, this guy, his name is Mark Needham, that I interned or not interned, he was like my mentor. I went and I became his assistant. So I left East West, I moved over to his operation. And Mark, I learned a ton from Mark. He's a fantastic engineer, mixer, and producer. But I specifically wanted to go and work with him because he was such a great mixer. I mean, he did like The Killers, he did Imagine Dragons, he did like a lot of that kind of era. He did like Neon Trees. That song Animal was like one of my favorite songs. That
So
was
that's
all
funny that
him.
you say that. Did he mix The Killers when they did Mr. Brightside?
Yeah, I
Or
think I'm pretty sure Brightside is his mix. And
because
it's funny
it's funny you say
because
that because
that.
I that was
Go
one of
ahead.
the reference tracks in my head of like the mono stuff because there's all these mono like synths and stuff going on like in that song where it's like normally like if that was produced today you'd have that same synth layered three times and left right so, like it'd be crazy but it's funny that that's the case but I apologize totally my tangent
No,
now
no, no. Yeah,
continue
all good.
that's wild.
It's a, I mean, dude, that song is still on the top 10 charts in the UK right now. Like, it's still in the top 10. Like, what is it, 12 years later, 15
Absurd.
years later,
It's
something
absurd.
like that? So, yeah, clearly that song, has some real staying power out there, and people love it. It's great. That whole record is great. And I remember, being like a teenager and I heard that record come out, and I was just like, how did they fucking do that? Like, because it was so aggressive and like, it had like a real vibe, a real sound to it. And so all those years later to have ended up working for the guy who made it was a really unique opportunity. And I learned, like I said, I learned a ton from him. Mark was not a great teacher. Like he did not sit me down and be like, this is how you EQ a snare, but he was fantastic at like kind of facilitating an environment where learning was possible. So his way of doing that was, okay, you're going to make all the stems every night when I'm done mixing for all the records that I'm mixing, which is a laborious process of like soloing each, instrument in a song and printing the stem in real time. And, Mark would mix like 500 songs a year. The guy is prolific. And so, but
Wow.
in opening up all those sessions and seeing stuff, like I got a ton of ideas from like, oh, interesting. That's how he does that. Like, I'm gonna try something similar. So yeah, like I said, man, I was super lucky because, there's not a ton of like at the very top of the record industry, there's maybe like 10 or 20 mixers who are doing like most of the big releases. But I say all that just to say like how important, finding people who are doing what you're doing already, and then finding a way to kind of make yourself valuable to those people. And then finding ways where maybe, maybe you're not getting the exact experience that you wanted to get out of it, but reframing that into like, okay, how do I make this into the experience that I want? And then, yeah, so I worked for Mark for maybe 3 or 4 years, and then he had so much kind of lower budget work being thrown at him that he could not afford to do because he was already so busy, and we had enough kind of like extra gear lying around, enough to scrape together another Pro Tools rig that I was like, Mark, let me help mix these like smaller records that come in, and like I'll learn that way, and you can, let me know a price that's fair to you, and like we'll do it that way. And that's how I kind of started growing my own
That's so
business.
cool, man. So now, where are you now? Are you in your own studio, or are you still under a major studio, or how are you set up now?
No, I've been totally freelance for like the last 5 years. I'm in a studio in the on the west side of LA right now that I rent. So I have my own, kind of space. It's a private space that I work out of. And I try to make it available also for anytime I have an assistant or an intern or something like that. I like to make it available for them in my downtime to use for their own learning. That's important to me that, the skill set gets passed on to other people. So, yeah.
No, that's phenomenal, man. It's such a good story. I love that. And like I said, you've had some phenomenal insights, some that I was selfishly like taking notes on over here. But it's good stuff for sure.
Yeah, I know. We probably didn't like hit on, I mean, I've only seen a few of the interviews on your channel, but I know we didn't hit a ton on sort of
What's
like the normal stuff, but
No, that's the beauty of it. That's why I love these things, 'cause so many like they're all very different, and everybody kind of has a different perspective on things. But like I think that like the goal is for people to learn, myself included, but also the listeners to learn as well. And in reality, like they were some very valuable lessons that could be learned here. It's maybe not how to become, where you are today, but there was a lot of tips in there, I think, that you just said, as you were speaking, I think that are really, really valuable. So I really appreciate you. The last question I like asking everybody to wrap up, though, is what is something you currently know now in your career that you wish you knew when you first started?
Oh man, that relationships are everything.
100%.
That's,
I'm laughing
yeah.
because like that's like the key. Like I've done close to 100 of these interviews, and like everybody's it's all about relationships, and having good relationships, because you could have relationships that are very poor quality or one-sided, but it's like all about good relationships is the key.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my career, I've been really lucky and I've had some success and I'm very grateful for that, but there's also been, like a lot of us, there's been some really rough times. I was really struggling with like being burnt out just from getting overworked and all that stuff, and I definitely in hindsight know that like, I did not really put those relationships first and realize how important that they were, and a lot of them kind of slipped through the cracks. And so now, like even as far into this as I am, I still feel like I'm starting over in some ways all the time with like, wanting to make connections with people that are like lasting and that are good. And that's, it's been a valuable thing to learn, because yeah, because I mean, none of us can do what we're doing unless there are other people.
100%.
Like,
Right.
yeah,
And that's a
not
beneficial
one-man
thing to
show.
learn early on, like you were saying,
Yeah.
like rather than like 10 years into like your career, 5 years, 3 years, like. But I think a key, actually, I want to add on to your thing that I would like to add is I think the key is to also f to build relationships for where you are. I think so many times, you know, we want to build really relationships with people, but we're looking like 17 steps ahead. And like it's at that point it would be a very one-sided relationship because you're not likely going to be able to offer anything to, you know, a guy that's producing these Grammy-winning songs, you know, like if you're just starting
Totally.
off. So it's like build relationships with the people that are at your level. And that's something that I personally learned recently, like about, you know, the past couple of years. Like when I was first starting off with my career, let's talk specifically YouTube, like I was so lonely, man. I had no friends because I was doing all this music stuff by myself. And but I would always be like, oh, I want to connect with that guy, but he had like a million followers or whatever. It's like there's no relationship there. So find people at your own level that you can build, you know, and then you start to like level up and such essentially. But like create relationships with people that are surrounding you rather than always looking up, I think is, I'm not,
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
speaking to the listener here, that's something I've definitely learned is
Yeah,
key to it.
for sure. And I think also, you know, just like beware the kind of like transactional mindset. Like there's nothing wrong with recognizing that, like, hey, I'm in this place and like this is where I would like to be, you know, doing this thing that this person does. But like if you treat people as a means to an end, like you're not going to get far, man. Like people are ends in and of themselves and like deserve to be respected. And ultimately, like the reason that we're doing this is because it's fun. So like if you're having like find people that you can have fun doing with what you're doing and grow together. And I think that's like if you view it that way, like you'll
100%.
go a lot further than if you're like, oh, that person has what I want, I'm going to go after it. And like here's how I can like manipulate the situation to get what I want. Like nobody wants to be around that kind of energy, especially in a creative environment like the studio, because, you know, as creators, I think we're all pretty sensitive, you know, and like it's, you pick that up in a second and like it's not fun to be around. So, yeah,
100%.
definitely.
Well, I really
So,
appreciate your time. If you could hang out for 30 more seconds, I just want to say thank you to every single person that watched this and made it to the end of the interview. You guys are true ones. You definitely, I hope you watch this again with a second time with a notebook because there were definitely some great insights that Ben dropped in here for sure. So definitely go check out all the stuff that Ben is up to. Go follow him on social media and everything. All the links will be down in the description. Best way to support my channel is by checking out my own original music and subscribing, and I'll see you in the next video. Thanks so much for watching. God bless and peace out.